I'm talking to Lucy LaPar about her new book, Pueblo Chico, The Lands and Lives in Galisteo Since 1814. First, let me say welcome to Women's Focus.
Well, I'm a great fan of Women's Focus.
I've been working on the Galisteo Basin and information about it for a long time, but it must feel so good to get it actually there in book form.
Yeah, actually, I set out to write one book on the Galisteo Basin, including the village, and then I got, which is very common for me, I got carried away, and I got so involved in the archaeology and history that that became one book, and then the village with the recent times, and it was yet to come. And I decided to just focus on the village, because at that time, the wonderful Bill Baxter was still alive, and he was sort of covering the West Basin. And he did a couple of books on that, but he unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. So the West Basin, somebody else can do that.
Well, and so it's just gone into print, as I understand. It's just
it
kind
of tiptoed out, given the times.
One of the things I wanted to talk about was some of the women that you mentioned in the story. And in the history of Galisteo, and I was surprised at the number of women that are living there or have been living there. But I thought we might start with a story at the beginning of the book, and it kind of gives people the flavor of Galisteo in a good way, I think. And that's the story about Carmelita Chavez when she was married.
Yeah, but when she was getting married, the bridge over the creek had been destroyed. It was constantly being destroyed. I mean, now when you look at the Galisteo River, the Rio Galisteo, the mighty River Galisteo, it's about ankle deep, and it's very hard to understand how it took out all these bridges over the years. But then in October 2017, we had this tornadic event, and the creek was from bank to bank. It was 6 feet deep or something and 65 feet wide. And so anyway, you sort of understand that the bridge could go out. And then when Carmelita was getting married, she was transported by wagon. She had to ford the creek to get to the church to get married.
Yes, I love that story. It's not as though they decided to have it someplace else.
No, well, she couldn't have gotten anywhere else any more easily. You had to cross the creek to get to the other side.
Well, that sort of tells us about Galisteo. Tell me why you wanted to find this history, why you dug up all these details.
Well, in my old age, I'm 83, I sort of got more interested in history than I had been previously. And Galisteo is such a fascinating place. And when I moved here, I was looking for the books about Galisteo, and there were only a couple of sort of strange little things. Father Stanley did one. He was an odd chronicler with no documentation whatsoever. And I got to know the community, and I am in the fire department on the auxiliary level, bake sale level. And I've done a lot of work with community planning, and I'm on the water board now and so forth. So increasingly the community kind of began to obsess me. And then I just was hearing all these stories from local old families. And they all contradict each other, of course. So I can do my multiple truths thing by saying nobody really knows what happened here. I'm very curious now that a couple of the families have the book by now, and I've given it to them, and I'm waiting to get flack for how could dare you say that about my great-grandfather or something. But I know that. The subtitle for Pueblo Chico, it was not a subtitle, but it's on the first page, is an old Spanish dicho and a New Mexican one, too. It says Pueblo Chico, Infierno Grande. So little town, big hell. So there's a certain, certain amount of that in the book, and I'm praying that the people don't take it wrong or think I did something terrible and so on. But.
Well, I think if they read the whole book, and get it in context, it's hard to argue with the way that you're portraying the people. Another phrase that you used that was telling, I thought, was that the sense of time is flexible.
Yes.
In what people recall.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people in the village, the grandparents and so on, didn't go to school past maybe the third or the sixth grade or so. So history as such didn't mean much to them, but the history of the village was very important, and the history of their family was very important, and so stories would come down. And I read someplace recently that memory is very flexible, and the more you remember, the more inaccurate it is.
And you also found that the property lines were very flexible, too, as you looked back. And I thought it was interesting that you went to that sort of detail of what sort of deeds they had filed and what ownership was.
Well, I don't think I cracked the surface of that, because the land grant situation, as you know, in New Mexico is crazy. And they were always, when the Anglos came in, when the Americans came in, they managed to have lawyers who bilked people out of their lands and so forth. And it's really a horrible story, but the actual facts are extremely hard to dig up. So it's often stories.
The land is different now. You also point that out. There are different things growing. You see different birds. And
exactly.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that, some of the things that have changed over the ages.
Well, for one thing, I don't see skunks and coons and porcupines and what have you around at all anymore. And I don't hear as many coyotes. And I live right by the creek, so they're down there. I mean, the wildlife is definitely there, but it's not up the bank for some reason. When I first arrived, there was a porcupine up in the big tree next to my house, and it was there for two or three days, and I got worried about it, city girl that I was, and I called animal control, and I said, there's a poor porcupine stuck in this tree. And the guy said to me, lady, it's the tree you should worry about, not the porcupine. So anyway, I also, when I was trying to figure out where to build a house, I wandered around my 5 acres, and I found 13 different wildflowers. But isn't that wonderful? And that was the last year I've ever seen that many wildflowers, and that was 1993. It is very different. I mean, obviously climate change is taking its toll. And
yeah, so it really has changed.
And of course, it's changed also because of gentrification, which I am obviously part of, because the village used to be a working farming village and all Hispano. And then I think I came on just on the cusp, I think I said in the book, when I started to go to community meetings, and there would be a line of the Anaya families shaking your hand or something to show you who was who in the village. And that hasn't happened for years and years. It's much more an Anglo situation now. And richer and richer people came in. Some of them are very supportive to the community and wonderful people, and some of them aren't. But we have desperately changed the village.
Well, how did you end up in Galisteo? How did you pick that area particularly?
Well, Harmony Hammond, who was a very old friend from New York, and we worked on the heresies. Feminists got me here. And Judy Chicago, I think the first time I ever went to Galisteo was with Judy to see the Halley's Comet up on the Hogback, on the Crestone. And I didn't really see the village, but they said, oh, you'd like it here. There are all these petroglyphs, and I was a rock art freak. And then Harmony, when I was still living in part-time in Colorado, Harmony said, well, if you come down, take a look at this place, because I'm thinking of buying it. And it was the La Lanera, which is the old wool barn of the Ortiz y Pinos, which had not been in their family for a couple generations. Anyway, so I started visiting Harmony, and I just fell for the place. But the first time I was here, when I walked across to see what the village was like, I walked across the bridge, and I thought, boy, this place is foreign. I mean, I was still a New Yorker with a vengeance. And I loved it, but it was very different. And now I live on La Otobanda, which is the other side of the creek, which at one point was vaguely the other side of the tracks, I think, but now is not now. And I fell for it the minute I sort of saw it, and then suddenly my mother died, and I had some money for the first time in my life, and this strip of land on the east side of the creek opened up, and I dashed in and bought a piece of it.
Well, was it the views that you can have, or was it the sort of village-type atmosphere?
Well, just a little everything. Bit of both. I mean, certainly the views, you know. I built by the highway, which everybody thought was weird, but I looked straight out on the rangeland and the mountains, and a highway where very few cars go by is not a big deal for a New Yorker. So, and I didn't have to watch what was built in front of me. Nothing was built in front of me. I just got to look out. But also, you know, I knew Harmony. I had met Ramona Scholler, and I knew a few people here. So I knew there was a community more like my old community, my art community. And then when I got here, the fire department turned out to be the place that was really the sort of mixture of the best place to kind of cross culture and income and so forth.
The fire department.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have a whole lot of fires, but we have medical stuff and so on. So, and I helped build a fire station.
So that's what brought the community together, was the fire department?
Yeah, well, it attracted Anglos and Hispanos, and that split wasn't there as much in the fire department.
Had you been looking for...
I've been coming to New Mexico since 1972, so it wasn't like it was a fun place in that sense. I knew other people here, and I used to stay cat sit or just stay with Judy Chicago on Canyon Road, and so I was familiar with it, and, you know, I was fascinated by it. And I'd been teaching in Boulder for one semester a year, and I knew I didn't want to stay in Boulder, and now I look at Boulder, and I think I'm really glad I didn't, because it's just become a sort of megalopolis or whatever they say.
One of the things you said in the book that I thought was interesting was you were at an age that you didn't want to have to move again, so this had to be the place.
Yes, this was. Well, I fell for Galisteo as soon as I saw it in the daylight. And I used to hike with friends from Colorado down on the Crestone when you could still do that, the Southern Crestone, so-called Comanche Gap. And, so I knew the territory. I mean, it wasn't like I was dropping into some totally foreign place.
Yeah. When you talk about some of the people as you go back in the history and give a flavor of what the village is like and what the people are who live there, you talk about people living in place and a lived experience, which is, I think, what you want to capture when you're telling the story. Could you talk a little bit about what you were after with that?
Well, I don't think I was aiming at anything. I just kind of scribble. But I've always valued lived experience over theory. And so I like the idea that, you know, you can talk about things when you've lived them, but you shouldn't be messing in other people's lives when you have no experience of it. So that was kind of the lived experience. But I've been harping on lived experience for many years.
And did you feel as though when you discovered the stories, and sometimes I think you must have found out more about people's histories than they knew themselves, you kind of were able to step into their lives a little bit?
A little, yes. I mean, you know, as an Anglo and newcomer and so forth, I try not to trespass too much. I trespass on the land a lot, but I don't trespass on people's experiences and so forth. But of course, there are a lot of stories that I did not put in the book.
And that's what people are probably worried about.
Yeah. Actually, one woman called me and she said, I'm just worried about what you might say about my father. And I said, well, read the book. Let me know.
So before we started recording, you said that it was just getting out to some people. So
yeah, it's barely gotten into the village. I get author's copies and I'm giving them to the people who were big help in writing the books.
Something that you bring out as you discover how the village has changed and the families that are in the village. And of course, I was interested in some of those names that we hear about in New Mexico a lot, like Ortiz y Pino, especially.
Yeah.
That you talk about the divisions and the sort of ancient feuds that have been going on forever, and probably the people have almost forgotten about them, I would imagine.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Memories are, I talk about other people's memories, but the memories are quite strong about things that happened. In fact, when I first started the newsletter, which I've done for 24 years now, a monthly newsletter, community newsletter, which, by the way, has been obviously was a huge help in getting the book going. But one local family member said, we don't need no newsletters or no local history or anything because our families are still feuding about things that happened 100 years ago. I realized, yeah, I thought that sounded very silly, but it wasn't. It was perfectly true.
And so you found that those divisions go back all that time and that people
Yeah, well, the younger generation is certainly doing its best to get over that stuff, but it's still there. It's still kind of running underground.
You did talk about sometimes when the village does get together and there are fiestas and times that people all sort of come together.
Yeah.
Still.
The best
on.
One is a new thing that was started by Tom Morin, who's long gone now, but the chili and margarita fiesta cook-off. It's a competition, best chili and best margarita. But that's because it's got booze. It's one of the most fun events of the village. Everybody's more relaxed.
Do you know if this is typical, if other villages of Penasco or other places have this kind of effort or not?
I think Galisteo is, unique in the sense that it's been gentrified so much. It's so close to Santa Fe. It's no longer a working village. I don't think there's very little comparison with the little village. I have a good friend who lives in El Valle, for instance, and her experience is very, very different. And, you know, Penasco, all the northern villages, they're still more grounded than this village is.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there's still more generations living in the same places and so forth. And Galisteo has really, there are less Hispano families than there are Anglo families, and it's been changed. I mean, I think I have this in the book, that within a week or two, I ran into two women who were in their probably 60s. One of them said, I would never live in Galisteo now. It's changed too much. And the other one said the same thing. She said, you know, it's not our village anymore. So, and that's perfectly true.
And I guess part of that is because it's close to Santa Fe and El Dorado.
Well, El Dorado wasn't there. I mean, even when I first came, there was no supermarket, no gas station or anything in El Dorado. And I don't think El Dorado has too much to do with Galisteo, but it's, you know, the old homes have been sold off and tarted up by wealthier people, and it is a different community.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't their community anymore, which is very sad. But I mean, people get along, and then sometimes people don't get along. And there's a great rumor mill and so forth, but I think the Hispano community feels that they have, you know, lost their community on some level, and they have.
Yes, I know that's sad. Let's talk about some of the women there. Of course, Concha Ortiz y Pino is someone that everyone has heard about, but let's talk about her and then about the others who are living there or have been.
Well, Concha lived mostly in Santa Fe, and they had a fancy house in Santa Fe and Galisteo, the Ortiz y Pino. I know you've got another Ortiz y Pino on your program today, but that branch of the family is quite a different branch. Their great grandfather, or whatever it is, was the brother of Don Jose, who was the great empire builder for one generation.
And then Agnes Martin, I didn't realize that she had a house there.
She was here when I came. No, she lived in Cuba for quite a long time, and then she came to Galisteo, and I think she was here for around 20 years or so, and then went back to Taos, where she had actually started out at one point. And as you know, she died years ago. So.
Yes, but I didn't realize that she had lived in Galisteo, and did she spend time in the village?
Yeah, I mean, she liked the village. At one point, this is a story that I never experienced, but she dug a swimming pool for the kids in the village in her yard. It was just a big mud hole, as far as I can tell. But she said it was only for children and no adults. And then she said people didn't respect it, and she filled it in, and that was that. But, I mean, you know, she was a character, and I think the village, you know, a lot of people were fond of her.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. And then, of course, Harmony did end up getting a house there.
Oh, yeah, she was here several years before I was, and I started staying with her, and that's how I saw that the place across the creek was up for grabs. Yeah,
and
she was here in I can't remember the year, 87 maybe, 89, somewhere around in there.
And she still lives there, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then the other person that surprised me was the woman who writes the cookbooks.
Oh, Deborah Madison.
Deborah Madison, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, they've been here. Her husband, Patrick McFarlane, is an artist, and he actually used the what is called La Sala, which was the old dance hall across from the church. He had that for a studio for a while. Yeah, Deborah's been here. She has a huge garden, and they've been here a good, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years.
I remember seeing pictures of her standing in her garden, hip deep in greenery.
She's a terrific gardener. And then recently, Peggy Diggs and Ed Epping, who are both artists, moved into the house two doors down from me, and they've been a great asset, too. A lot of fun to have them around.
So it is a place that attracts artists, obviously.
Yeah, except that I always get sort of annoyed when people think of it as an artist village, because it still is the old Hispano village. They never gave it up, you know, and it's not just art. I mean, a lot of the artists, well-known artists who've been in and out, have not been particularly participant in the village activities or working on the organizations or anything. But the studio tour every year is a great thing that a lot of people work on or have worked on.
Yes, I actually did that one year. But it isn't like Madrid, where people just go through every Sunday trying to see the artists' homes.
In fact, there's just nothing. I mean, in fact, even the studio tour, you don't usually get into the homes. There's usually, you know, it's either they're in the community center with other artists, or they have a separate studio or something. So if people come to, like, get into people's homes, it doesn't work very well.
Are there other women?
There are very strong Hispano women. There's Mela Montoya, Mela Anaya Montoya, who was a very important person in the village. We didn't have a school at that point, so she went to Stanley to school and was the valedictorian in the high school when she graduated. And then there's Mary Alice Anaya, who wasn't raised here but has been here forever, and her husband died quite a long time ago. And she's a sort of a matriarch of the village. And then Ana Cardenas, who is Mela Montoya's daughter, is still very active, really almost the only Hispana who's still very active in community affairs. And she's been president of the community association there, so has her husband been. And they've been on the water board and all the different boards and so forth.
I was thinking that community life must be different, though, now that there are fewer people, because at one point there were many more people who were living off the land.
Yeah, it's certainly more than now, which is about 260 people. I always say this book has to be the fattest book ever done on a village this size. I mean, overdone or something. But at one point, there may have been 1,000 people or 800 or something. The censuses are kind of vague, because they talk about the Galiseo district, and it was unclear as to whether that was the village or it wasn't just the village, actually. So it's kind of hard to pin down the populations, but it was, you know, around the turn of the century in late 1800s, it was bigger.
And do you feel now that it's protected, that it's going to, that the encroaching development that you talk about is not going to happen?
Well, that's not going to happen, but something else is probably coming down the pike. That got luckily sort of killed off by the 2008. And recession or whatever they call it. But there's still land, especially to the north. To the south of the village is mostly ranch land, and would be, I don't know if the San Cristello Ranch will ever break up on one side, but of course the Thornton Ranch did break up, and the Galisteo Preserve and so forth. So you never know what's coming down, but we've been fighting various developments, and so far, so good. But, I mean, and then, of course, there's Ranchitos de Galisteo, which was the first subdivision here in the 80s, I think. Look at the book. I'm not getting any more dates right. anyway, that's a whole other. And some of the people who live there are second homes and things, and some of them are very involved in the village. So they consider themselves in Galisteo, and they are, although some of the old Hispanos have said, well, we don't think that's part of Galisteo.
And I guess El Dorado probably takes care of some of the development that people can't do without or whatever.
Yeah, but it's, you know, Galisteo is a very different place than El Dorado, so I think there are people who are attracted to this. And somebody said at one point, you know, they'd buy a place in Ranchitos and then they'd sell it a few years later because they discovered that it wasn't La Jolla.
Yes. I laughed at that. Well, what is happening now in terms of what you're working on? And
I'd like to think I can stay in Galisteo till I go out feet first, but driving is going to be a problem eventually, so who knows. But I'm writing something. I just started a project called The Burden of Memory. I'm still involved in history stuff on monuments, sort of musings on monuments. So that's what I'm into now, including contemporary artists who are doing things with monuments. But, I mean, you know, the New Mexico's, the Entrada stuff, the Charlene Teeter's obelisk, the carving out of the savages thing in the obelisk in the plaza, there's a lot of New Mexico monument stuff that's very interesting. So there'd definitely be one essay on that.
Well, just to end our discussion about Galisteo, tell people about your day, your daily hike, and what that's like, because that's something that I like to think about, that you sort of reflected a little bit.
Well, I my daily hikes have been curtailed because I've got a really bad knee now, but for years I just would look out the window and think, oh, I think I'll go over there today. And I was lucky. I never got shot or arrested or anything. I didn't have a dog then. I had a cat, so I didn't have an animal with me that might be chasing stock and so forth, because at one point, one of my neighbors, lovely, pregnant, golden retriever, was shot dead on the San Cristobal Ranch. And she was chasing an antelope. She wasn't chasing their cattle, but they shot her anyway. So that was kind of sad. But anyway, luckily, before I realized, really before things tightened up, I think there was a point where the county demographics changed to the point where there were just too many people out looking for things, and, you know, petroglyphs are just hiking across things and leaving gates open and letting their dogs chase duck and things like that. But I had a wonderful time trespassing everywhere in the Galisteo Basin before I did the last book, the Downcountry book. And then I figured I had to keep some kind of decent reputation going for the book, so I stopped trespassing as much. I didn't want to say the author is now in jail. I mean, but I have a dog now, so we walk twice a day, but it's much shorter than it used to be.
Oh. Well, it still sounds like a wonderful feeling about being able to look out and decide where will I go today.
Yes, that was wonderful. That was years. I mean, now it's been 27 years or 28 years or I didn't get a good dose of the basin before I got crippled.
When was it that you actually moved to Galisteo? How many years have
93,
you been
there? 93, okay. So it's about 27 years.
Well, I certainly hope that your ties with your neighbors and with the people in the village aren't strained by this book.
Well, I've been doing the newsletter for 24 years, so they know who I am.
Oh, right.
So we'll see what happens, but I'm a little apprehensive about it.
They'll know what to expect, though. I've been talking to Lucy Lepard, and the name of the book is Pueblo Chico, Lands and Lies in Galisteo, since 1814. And it's published by Museum of New Mexico Press. I think before you had things planned.
We'll probably do something small in Galisteo just for locals. I mean, I've only had my copies for a couple of weeks now, so it's just tiptoeing out, as I put it. And you can get it from the press. Get it online from the press. Do by all means try collected works and bookworks and so forth first, because the bookstores really need that support.
Okay, good. Well, I really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks so much for doing this.
I never thought of Galisteo Street in Santa Fe as being connected to Galisteo at all until you talked about that in the book.
And Galisteo Road is out to the south a little bit, so, you know, it was the way to Galisteo at one point.
Yeah, and that didn't occur to me. So there's all these places now that I want to go and see.
I did my damnedest to get La Gente into the book, and there's far less documentation. People didn't have photographs, you know. I mean, it was much harder.
I appreciated that. It was good to hear about the other people and the other names and things like that. So,
I mean, it still wasn't enough for one person to say, well, it's not enough about us in here.
I don't think people will be complaining, but anyway, what do I know? Okay. It was great to talk to you.
Yes, good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.